the headlines, millions of Muslims mourn on Ashura, commemorating the historic Battle of Karbala and its message of resistance against injustice and tyranny. Truckloads of fuel arrives in Gaza hours after Islamic Jihad agrees to a ceasefire, ending 3 days of deadly Israeli airstrikes. Plus, the UN chief raises the alarm over the risk of nuclear confrontation on the anniversary of the first atomic bombing by the U.S. nearly 8 decades ago. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, millions of mourners across Iran mark Ashura, the martyrdom anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. Every year, black-clad mourners mark the occasion with processions or ceremonies to show their grief over the sufferings of Imam Hussein and his companions. Many also converge on religious centers, such as mosques, to commemorate the event. The rituals involve mourners beating on their chests and reciting elegies in honor of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. Ashura is the 10th day of the Muslim calendar month of Muharram. It is the day when Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred in the plains of Karbala in modern-day Iraq. They were killed by forces of the tyrannical ruler of the time, Yazid, in the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD. Sayyid Mustafa Khushchashm is a political commentator based in Tehran. He told us about the philosophy of Ashura.
There are many across the globe who admire Hussein. And this is believed to be the most important day throughout the year, because it's not just a religious occasion. It's politics. It's everything. It's life. It shows how it sets an example for anyone. During the fights on the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein alayhi salam said to the opposite side that if you are not faithful, if you don't believe in God, at least be free men, free from, this has a lot of meaning, because freedom doesn't just mean freedom from tyranny, from, obedience to tyrant rulers, but freedom from money, from the lust for money, the lust for everything in life.
A convoy of fuel trucks has entered Gaza hours after the Palestinian Islamic Jihad agreed to ceasefire with Israel. The fuel was delivered through the southern crossing into the besieged territory. This comes after 3 days of Israeli airstrikes and retaliatory attacks by the Islamic Jihad. The fighting was triggered by an Israeli strike that assassinated a leader of the Palestinian resistance movement in Gaza on Friday. The Israeli aggression killed 45 Palestinians, including 15 children, and wounded 360 others. Well, here are the reactions of the people in Gaza to Israel's deadly airstrikes against the besieged territory.
The house was overcrowded with no less than 22 members, and around it there were 6 houses that were all damaged. And this happened without a warning. It was horrifying. They targeted the house with 5 or 6 rockets. There were body parts on the ground. It's horrifying.
They target people. They target helpless people who are safe in their homes. They target children and old people. They do not have mercy. Who can we complain to?
This building has 3 apartments, shops including smithy shop, aluminum shop, a carpenter shop, a fish store, chicken store. This is a tragedy. We appeal to the Arab countries and Muslims to stand with us.
Three days of Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip has led to the deaths of dozens of people, including women and children. The atrocities came to halt after a truce was announced. The reasons for the Israeli aggression are now in focus, with the regime claiming its strikes were preemptive.
Gaza was flashed bright by explosions as Israeli artillery and other weapons targeted what they say were weapons factories and rocket launch sites belonging to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Following the latest round of aggression initiated by the Israeli military, an aerial duel was also held as rockets were fired from Gaza towards Israel, some intercepted by the Israeli Iron Dome anti-missile system, yet many penetrated deep inside Israel, reaching as far as Tel Aviv. Earlier, in a televised address, the Israeli Prime Minister said the regime had zero tolerance for attacks from Gaza and that isn't interested in a wider conflict in Gaza but will not shy away from one either. Israel has labeled the latest round of aggression as a preemptive operation. It says it aimed to thwart alleged planned rocket attacks by the Islamic Jihad. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad called the initial Israeli bombardment a declaration of war, firing a barrage of at least 100 rockets into southern Israel. Around 13 people were taken to the hospital with minor injuries. Some reports have, however, indicated that many Israelis were killed in the retaliatory attacks. In response to the Israeli aggression, the Al-Quds brigades launched attacks on cities across the occupied territories. Hamas also announced its support for the Islamic Jihad and said it would respond to the strikes. Israel claims it targets military sites, but similar to all other attacks by the regime, civilians seem to be on the receiving end of the rockets.
Definitely, this is a war crime. It's a war crime in itself. The bombing in itself is a war crime. The siege of Gaza and the blockade for 15 years is a war crime. They're starving people, cutting off the electricity and cutting off the water supply and cutting off the ability for Palestinians to import much necessary food and building supplies and medicine and allow people to leave and come back is a war crime in itself. This is not acceptable. And that's one thing. The second aspect of it is that the fact that Israel has claimed and actually publicly announced that it is using this as a preemptive in itself is also a war crime, because even in international law of war, you are supposed to respond in a proportionate manner if you are being attacked. Actually, even this time, Israel itself admitted that there has been no provocation. Israel has been provoking again and again and again, and has been provoking the Palestinians in order to create a war with the Palestinians and in order to punish Palestinians again and again. So Palestinians have not done anything yet. And so Israel went and bombed and killed so many children, so many civilians, has destroyed again Gaza. This is apartheid. This is a crime against humanity.
Israel has continued its atrocities against Palestinians. Over the past years, the U.S. is particularly complicit in this, seeing its tacit support for Israel. During this latest episode, the U.S. urged all sides to avoid further escalation, but turning reality on its head, it added that the U.S., quote, absolutely fully supports Israel's right to defend itself. That's a green light to Israel to continue its bombing campaign.
The United States has time and again vowed to support Israel. This includes the U.S. President's latest trip to Israel, where he pledged full military support for Israel with regard to the Iron Dome, a new laser system, and other military support. And now regarding the latest round of attack against Gaza, the U.S. ambassador to the regime said Israel has a right to defend itself. That is a green light for Israel to continue with its rocket attacks. The U.K. Foreign Secretary also echoed similar remarks, adding that the kingdom stands by Israel.
Biden has continued support for Israel unconditionally. He repeated support for Israel and quote-unquote its security when it is not even threatened. It's the one that's threatening the security of the Palestinian people, including the children, women, elderly people, disabled, everybody. Israel is threatening the security. It's not the other way around. So for the United States to go around and for Joe Biden making so many promises during his campaign against Bush, against Trump, that he was going to roll back many of the aggressive actions of Trump, which were already before Trump, not really happily during Obama as well, and Joe Biden was his vice president. They were actually very problematic against the Palestinians. For Biden not to even reverse the steps, the aggressive steps that Trump has taken against the Palestinians, but to continue military aid, economic aid, collaboration with Israel, justification for Israel's attack on, it is giving a green light, and it is exactly the way we all understood it.
Those statements have, however, drawn criticism from the United Nations.
The UN Special Reporter on the Occupied Palestinian Territories slammed the US for the remarks and stated that Israel cannot claim that it is defending itself in this conflict. She also condemned the regime's attacks as illegal and irresponsible. Meanwhile, the office of the Palestinian president called this week's attack a dangerous escalation. The regime's attacks was also followed by a closure of two border crossings with the Gaza Strip. But Palestine has witnessed such acts of aggression from time and again, and the heaviest price is always paid by the civilians. The Gaza Strip has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. That is 15 years of a blockade. Israel has also waged many wars against the Gaza Strip and killed scores of Palestinians, yet there's no mention of this, while Russia's war in Ukraine takes center stage on a daily basis.
Well, up next is a new episode of Hashtag Trending, how social media reacted to the new Israeli bloodshed in the Gaza Strip.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another Hashtag Trending. The Gaza Strip is bleeding once again. Israel unleashed 3 days of deadly airstrikes on the besieged enclave, leaving dozens of Palestinians dead, razing their homes, while the international community sat back and watched the brutal massacre. At least 44 Palestinians, mainly civilians, died in Israeli air raids. The carnage began when Israel killed a Palestinian resistance commander, prompting retaliation from the resistance fighters in Gaza. Israel later accepted an Egypt-mediated truce amid heavy rocket fire from Gaza. Social media pages were flooded with tragic videos and images of death, destruction, and agony in Gaza. Many slammed the global community for keeping silent in the face of Israeli crimes in what they described as double standard approach towards human rights. Moving on to our next comment by Purva Chitnis. They wrote, once again, the hypocrite world is exposed. No one cares about how Israel is carrying out attack on Gaza. Children are being killed, families getting destroyed, houses are demolished, but no outrage or solidarity by the world. Another video here posted by Chris. We were sleeping when they bombed us. Palestinian girl recounts the horror of Israeli occupation airstrikes. Hashtag Gaza under attack. The eyes don't lie. So as social media users especially took notice of the plight of the children, 8 kids were killed in the Israeli raids and dozens were injured. They say that the global community refuses to take any noticeable action against Israel, really any action for that matter, because the victims are Muslims, and if it were anywhere else, things would look different. Let's take a look at our next batch of comments. Fatina said, they are not numbers, they are kids. Do you know what's the meaning of kids? Each one of them has a story, a dream, and a hope. They just want to live in peace and to play in the ground because they're just children. This is the simplest right. Moving on to the next one, a video by Sarab Al-Rawashda. With all the fear in their voices, begging to make sure if their families are still alive. This is what the children and people of Gaza are forced to go through constantly, while the whole world shut their eyes willingly. Our next tweet by Muhammad Habib al-Rahman reads, stop calling it a conflict. It's Israel terrorism. There won't be an international intervention or any sanctions against Israel as the victims are Muslims. World leaders, remember you have to answer these children on the day of judgment. Hashtag Gaza under attack. Some, however, highlighted the greater evil, which is Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestine. They believe that the regime will keep up its atrocities as long as it is allowed to continue its occupation. Now let's take a look at our final batch of tweets. The next one comes from Professor Sheikh Sadiq. 75 years ago, Israel was not a country. Arab people gave place to Jews to live. Today, the people of Israel are killing the people of Palestine. And he shared a photo, Israel Foundation date, in a Google search. Israel founded in 14th of May, 1948. A very short history, but a very long list of crimes in that short period of time. Next tweet, the world must know what is happening in Gaza away from the false media that enhances the image of the occupation. The occupation is not oppressed, but rather a great danger to Palestine, and that's an understatement if I've ever heard one. So this is, in action, the US and Western media trying to paint the occupation forces as the oppressed, but honestly, they're having a really hard time doing that nowadays. Our final tweet is by Noam Chomsky. A quote by Supporting Humanity was shared. It's almost impossible to think about. Gaza is 2 million people who are living in an open-air prison under constant attack.
It's almost impossible to think about. Gaza is 2 million people who are in the living in a prison, open-air prison, under constant attack.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of Hashtag Trending. Thanks for staying tuned. Take care, and bye-bye.
The United Nations Secretary General warns the world is facing the risk of a nuclear confrontation.
This is the moment when the risk of a nuclear confrontation is back, something that we have forgotten for decades. This is the moment, as I said, to ask the nuclear-armed countries to commit to the principle of non-first use.
Guterres says nuclear-armed countries must also commit themselves to not to threaten non-nuclear states with nuclear attacks. The UN chief says no one can accept the idea of a new nuclear war. Guterres made the comments in Tokyo after attending the ceremonies to mark the 77th anniversary of the U.S. nuke attacks on Hiroshima. Guterres also warned on Saturday that signals of a nuclear war flashing red, noting that the only solution to the nuclear threat is not to have nuclear weapons at all. Russia accuses Ukraine of shelling the Zaporizhia atomic power plant, warning of devastating consequences for Europe.
The shelling of the territory of the nuclear plants by the Ukrainian armed forces is a potentially extremely dangerous activity, fraught with catastrophic consequences for a vast area, including the territory of Europe.
The Kremlin spokesman also says Western countries with influence over Ukraine should push Kiev to stop shelling the nuclear plant. Russia currently controls the plant in southeastern Ukraine, Europe's largest nuclear power site, has come under several strikes in recent days. Both Russia and Ukraine have traded accusations over the attacks. Kiev says Russian strikes have damaged 3 radiation sensors and wounded a worker. Moscow says Ukrainian nationalists have damaged administrative buildings, power lines, and a water pipeline. Earlier, the United Nations Secretary General called any attack on a nuclear plant, quote, suicidal. Antonio Guterres also said that the International Atomic Energy Agency needs to have immediate access to the plant. Well, that's a wrap for now.
Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "Perform pilgrimage to Karbala, and don't stop doing this, for Karbala has embraced the best son of the prophets."
When your horse returns to our camp riderless.
أزور سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجاي.
The ocean of dua.
الإمام الحسين عليه السلام زيارة.
Why did you leave us?
to fend for ourselves. Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of زيارة إمام الحسين عليه السلام, زيارة العاشوراء. So stay with us.
برئت إلى الله وإليكم منهم ومن أشياعهم وأتباعهم وأوليائهم يا أبا عبد الله إني سلم لمن سالمكم حرب لمن حاربكم إلى يوم القيامة.
Brothers and sisters, previously we were discussing this excerpt of Ziyaratul Ashura. يا أبا عبد الله إني سلم لمن سالمكم وحرب لمن حاربكم إلى يوم القيامة. أو أبا عبد الله, I am at peace with he who is at peace with you, and at war with he who is at war with you, إلى يوم القيامة, until the day of resurrection. Regarding this part, until the day of resurrection, we mentioned different traditions from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, emphasizing on the importance of being with the Ahlul Bayt, acting according to their commands, which is the true meaning of being with them, and the importance of being with them until the day of resurrection and perpetually. In an important narration, Allah's Messenger is reported as saying, مَا بَالُ أَقْوَامٍ إِذَا ذُكِرَ عِنْدَهُمْ آلُ إِبْرَاهِيمِ فَرِحُوا وَاسْتَبْشَرُوا وَإِذَا ذُكِرَ عِنْدَهُمْ آلُ مُحَمَّدٍ إِشْمَأَزَّتْ قُلُوبُهُمْ. What is the matter with some people who get happy whenever they are reminded of the family of Ibrahim, but they are disturbed whenever they are reminded of the family of Muhammad? وَالَّذِي نَفْسُ مُحَمَّدٍ بِيَدِهِ لَوْ أَنَّ عَبْدًا جَاءَ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ بِعَمَلِ سَبْعِينَ نَبِيًّا مَا قَبِلَ اللَّهُ ذَلِكَ مِنْهِ حَتَّى يَلْقَاهُ بِوِلَايَتِي وَوِلَايَةِ أَهْلِ بَيْتِي. The Holy Prophet continues, by Allah, in whose hand is Muhammad's life, I swear, if on the day of judgment, a servant comes forth with the deeds of 70 prophets, Allah will not accept those deeds unless he meets him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, bearing love for me and my Ahlul Bayt, my progeny. And this is the embodiment of what we see in Ziyara Jami'a Kabira, as Imam Hadi alayhi salam says, وَأَشْرَقَتِ الْأَرْضُ بِنُورِكُمْ وَفَازَ الْفَائِزُونَ بِوِلَايَتِكُمْ بِكُمْ يُسْلَكُ إِلَى الرِّضْوَانِ وَعَلَى مَنْ جَحَدَ وِلَايَتَكُمْ غَضَبُ الرَّحْمَنِ. Your light lights up on the earth. Those who love and cherish you attain their end and conduct themselves to paradise. And those who forsake your friendship earn displeasure of the most compassionate Lord. So, if one is inclined towards the peak of perfection, he must first go to Ahlul Bayt and then adhere to them. In this connection, the Holy Quran says, إِن كُنْتُمْ تُحِبُّونَ اللَّهِ فَاتَّبِعُونِي يُحْبِبُكُمُ اللَّهِ. If you love Allah, then follow me and Allah will love you. If you love the peak point of perfection, you need to follow the heavens and the earth as the manifestations of the Almighty Allah. You need to love the Ahlul Bayt because its root is the love for peak of perfection. And if the Ahlul Bayt are Allah's favorites, it is because they are the best path for meeting Allah.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right, which madhab is right? Go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies, it clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is: do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates him, he understands his dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So one must try to stay with the Ahlul Bayt, listening to their commands, avoiding what they forbid, until the day of resurrection, even on the day of resurrection. In this regard, Imam Hadi alayhi salam says, نَحْنُ الصِّرَاطُ الْمُسْتَقِيمُ. We are the straight path. So, the Ahlul Bayt are not only the path, but they are Allah's rope, which is somehow extended from the heavens to the earth. And reaching the peak point of perfection, which is Allah, is only available just by holding fast by the covenant of Allah. The Ahlul Bayt are extended from Allah's grace, which is the truth of Muhammad, extended to all borders of the earth. This is one sign of the meaning of this verse of the Holy Quran. أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَيْفَ مَدَّ الظِّلِ. Have you not considered the work of your Lord, how He has extended the shade? So, everyone can be under the shade of the Ahlul Bayt if he wholeheartedly wills so. Whosoever is inclined toward the peak of perfection will grasp it in order to reach Allah. And this is what the Almighty Allah has ordered us. وَابْتَغُوا إِلَيْهِ الْوَسِيلَةِ. Seek means of nearness to him, and the Ahlul Bayt are the most complete meaning of this wasila. They are the meanings to reach towards the Almighty Allah. They are the link to Allah, and even denying one of them means disbelieving in the Almighty Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
أنت الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين
بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح
الدم لبيك يا حسين
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليك يا سار الله
Sorrowful is the sun as arrows reach the sky. Creation is in shock as you prepare to die. Everything you gave without complaint. You died a tragic death, but you did not die in vain. Hussein, 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 Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein.
The Uber files has been released, and it looks more like a rap sheet than anything else, from tax dodging to lobbying diplomats and foreign dignitaries to price manipulation. And from what we did at this economic divide program, this may involve dodgy financial accounting reporting. Hi, I'm Kavit Hathaway. Welcome to Economic Divide. Today's program is about the Uber files. Some of the topics that we'll be covering in today's program, the Uber leaks. It was reported that they broke laws, they duped police, and they exploited violence against drivers. Just some of the things that the Uber leaks revealed. Another highlight of the program, the strategy behind Uber. It undercut tax-free markets. It lobbied for new laws in order to protect them. And it also paved the way for the Uber application to be installed with the general masses. Of course, that produced controversies within itself. And finally, Uber friends, politicians, and barons, they acted against their own citizens. That is the cost of being friends with Uber.
Uber is a tech giant that provides mobility services globally. It allows users to book a car and a driver for transportation. Its services also include food delivery, package delivery, couriers, and freight transportation. The company is based in San Francisco, with operations in approximately 72 countries and 10,500 cities. Over the years, it has come to be known as a reliable service with 118 million monthly active users worldwide. With 19 million trips per day, generated over $17.4 billion in revenues in 2021. But Uber's success is not only due to the creativity and ingenuity of its founders.
In short, digital platforms have massive potential. They offer working flexibility, they create jobs, bring innovation, and cater for what is clearly a strong consumer demand. However, people are the heart are at the heart of this business model. They deserve the same protection and conditions as any other worker in any EU country, including access to collective bargaining and representation.
Uber technology, as it is called, is known to be a ride-sharing application, among other things. But the funny thing about this company is that there's more negative material out there than positive information on it. Then came the Uber files, and boom, that just pushed the controversies over the top. These are some of the things that people have said online about the company. First, to rig the marketplace so a company with $20 billion in financing but no actual competitive advantages could destroy operators who were willing to obey existing laws but had much less financing. Our next tweet comes from Chile, or on Chile, which says, following Italy, trying to bring down the government, taxi drivers protest against Uber licenses and the price of fuel. The Uber files prove that WEF connections allowed them to fund trading at a loss to force small businesses out of business. Well, talk about Italians. They are saying no to human beings' modern slavery, as it's been described, which is an oppression to drivers by Uber. And finally, we needed to take a look at the Uber files itself in terms of how it was described by the whistleblower who came forward, where it said, as a title, "We sold people a lie."
My name is Mark McGann. I'm a former senior executive at Uber, and I'm here as a whistleblower. I'm the one who revealed what's become known as the Uber files. I'd worked in highly stressful environments before. Uber was very different. It was very intense. Threats, violence, death threats on social media. And it's only when you come off that kind of hamster wheel and you take a step back that you realize how crazy it all was.
Ouch, that's gotta hurt. That's how this has been described. Let's introduce our guests, though, and see what they think. Sergio Avedian is a senior contributor at the Rideshare Guy who joins us. Sergio Avedian, welcome. Looking at this ride-sharing application by the name of Uber, it has its enemies not only within the U.S. but outside the U.S. The expansion that took place across the world was rather phenomenal, where hundreds of leaders in dozens of countries were courted. It included, obviously, politicians. But didn't the politicians act with regards to Uber in a way that it sacrificed their own citizens?
It obviously did, right? So all the existing cab companies, let's say, because when Uber first showed up, they showed up as a disruptor. Disruptor meaning they wanted to revolutionize public and personal transportation, which they have done. In some cases, obviously, not that the documents show, illegally, and in some cases, risking the lives of their own drivers. Well, we know what happened as far as in Europe is concerned, as well as the United States, that cab companies were not happy about this because Uber, is not a regulated company. While cab industry in all over the world is regulated industry by the local and state authorities.
All right, let's bring in Professor Joe Haslam and see what he thinks. We welcome him, executive director of the Owners Scale Up program at IE Business School in Madrid, Spain. Professor Joe Haslam, welcome to Economic Divide. Uber followed some unscrupulous business ethics, to say the least, in which taxi and cab markets were put under pressure. Governments were pushed to rewrite laws, and also we're looking at an app-based gig economy model of work that has since proliferated across the world. What is there to say that this is not going to happen in other industries within those countries who are, in essence, harming its workers?
Yeah, it's a great question. But the issue is, of course, is that the fun will continue until the money runs out. And a lot of these gig economy companies, these apps, super apps, whatever you want to call them, have been funded by venture capital. The idea that you invest for growth instead of profit and that you drive out all competitions and then raise prices. However, we're now at a period at the end of cheap money where it's not going to be possible anymore to fund these companies indefinitely. So I think there would have been a problem if we weren't at the end of cheap money, but I think the situation will sort itself out.
But the fact that Uber's IPO was not the success story that it should have been isn't really about the fundamentals of the company today. It's more about the fact that their valuation got too high too fast in the past, and that severely constrained their ability to set a fair price for their IPO when they went public.
It's time now for the info news section of the program. Our first item surely will catch your attention, and it is about something that actually relates to the Ukraine conflict. It's called deglobalization. That's right. World economy at risk of deglobalization based on what the IMF has said. Now, Russia's military operation in Ukraine and Western sanctions on Moscow, well, they might push the global economy into geopolitical fragmentation. That's kind of a dark side scenario that is another consequence of the Ukraine conflict. Next up, Kenya. Kenya's economy is our focus in this particular post that we brought out for you. Debt shadow clouds Kenya's forthcoming presidential polls. So obviously, as usual, the economy is what drives a poll or an election in this case. Kenya's economy at this point is Africa's sixth biggest, but its debt is up to two-thirds of the GDP. So debt plaguing Kenya is obviously a big burden on the economy there, not to mention other countries in Africa. Our next post is very dangerous in terms of the unity of Europe as a whole. That is our focus, where Europe's fight to stay united over the war in Ukraine, that's actually is being put to the test. That has been going on for some time. Now, Europe as a whole is now forced to wrestle with soaring inflation. We know that. The bloc is not as united as it seems. And we are seeing, obviously, the gas stoppage from Russia, which has amounted to quite a bit, especially for a country like Germany, to break this unity at this point, which seems to be inevitable in some senses. Next up, we go to the United States, a pact by the name of Schumer and Manchin. It's a tax and spending deal that they call the Inflation Reduction Act, in which new taxes and price controls to pay for green corporate welfare for the politically favored is the focus. Now, the question that many are asking is their aim to reduce inflation by chilling business investments and the economy? So obviously there's hidden factors that others are seeing in this pact between the two. Those were the ones that we picked in terms of news for you with the flavor of the economy in it. Of course, we would appreciate it if you Hello and welcome to our in-depth section. Uber as a company has been filled with controversies, no doubt about that. Now, aside from these controversies, in this in-depth section, we actually wanted to find out if Uber was profitable or not. I mean, that's a simple approach here, but yet a very important one. In other words, was it making money or was it still incurring losses? Well, we found out even that is a challenge in itself. For example, in the year 2019, this is what the company actually reported. The headline read, how can a company lose $5.2 billion in revenues of $3.2 billion? Uber is going to show you how. $5.2 billion in revenues, $3.2 billion is what actually came out of that in terms of losses. Now, that is the question that comes to mind. How can the company actually lose $5.2 billion when the revenues were only $3.2 billion? Now, breaking that down is actually very hard, and digesting it is actually harder, but here is what the profit and loss comes into view for the operation of Uber. We went back all the way to the year 2014 and then went all the way to the year 2019. The ones in the blue are the profits. The ones in the red are the losses. The thing is, Uber reported sales of only $3.2 billion. In other words, the net loss actually exceeded, again, sales by $2 billion. The loss of $5.24 billion added to the loss of $878 million in the first quarter. So overall, Uber lost $6.25 billion in the first half of 2019. Total revenue for the two quarters was $6.3 billion. All right, next up, let's fast forward to November 2021. Another shocking headlines, in this case in point, we're going to tell you what that means. Uber reports a loss, even as revenue jumped 72%, $5.9 billion losses from three of their other operations that they just splashed money onto, Didi Global, Grab Holdings, and Aurora. Again, $5.2 billion in losses. The revenues jumped, according to them, 72%. But thanks to its $3.2 billion loss in those three ventures, that was called the write-down. The amount, again, $5.2 billion. It said that this loss was due to unrealized losses from these stakes that I just mentioned. So there you have another headline where the numbers just don't add up in terms of the conclusion that is being reached. Now, we then proceeded actually to look at the figures from the actual books at Uber in terms of its profit and loss statements. Well, this is what we found out. Uber's fourth quarter and full year results for the year 2021, very recent, gross bookings at $25.9 billion. That's up 72% year over year. Net income recorded $892 million, which is almost $1 billion. That's the actual, figures that is the most current that we had based on what Uber actually reported, which projected a gross bookings of, as we mentioned, $25.9 billion with a net income of $892 million. Now, let's move on to the company's CEO, Mr. Khosrow Shahi. That's right, he's Iranian origin. He has said that Uber's driver base is, from what he has said, at a post-pandemic high to explain some of the high figures or the profitability projection. And he said that it expects engagement to continue without significant incremental incentive investments. He has to say that. See, people have to realize that because he has to show that there's momentum in the money that Uber is making and also at the same time explain the loss, but that it's moving forward in terms of the money that the company is actually making. If you didn't understand that, that's okay. Let me bring in Sergio Avedin. He's the senior contributor who rejoins us at the rideshare guy. All right, Sergio Avedin, welcome back to Economic Divide. We are looking at this leaked trove of confidential files. Lots of revelations there. It flouted the laws. It duped police. Things that you're very much familiar with. At this point, why was there such a drive then behind Uber to go to these lengths to offer a service which sounds like it shouldn't be so intricate when it comes to a ride-sharing application? What are your thoughts on that?
Thanks for having me on. I'm from the first day, actually, all the way to today, Uber doesn't call itself a rideshare company to start with. That's just a word that just came around. They call themselves a technology company. So the reason for that is because they have been breaking the local city and state and federal laws, labor laws, transportation laws from their inception. So to me, you know, this is not that much of a surprise. These documents have been floating around for a while. I've known about these documents for a while. You know, look, they have to do what they have to do. You know, they went to lengths of breaking laws, obviously, and lobbying efforts. And as we know, in politics today, lobbying is in every issue is very strong. I'm not condoning what they did. But they were also trying to protect close to 50, 60, at some point, $100 billion worth of market capitalization.
All right. Thank you very much, Sergio Avedin. Perhaps he gave us a bit of a background behind the numbers that we just covered. All right. Let's bring back Mr. Joe Haslam, Executive Director at Owner Scale Up Program, who rejoins us from Madrid, Spain. Welcome back, Joe Haslam. We're trying to find out an explanation behind the numbers that Uber has offered behind the way that the company has acted in terms of not only its operations, but also in terms of the aggressive global expansion that it has gone through. How do you explain the way that Uber has acted, and why has it gone through such lengths to offer what appears to be a ride-sharing application?
No, a lot of this comes down to the Silicon Valley philosophy of rugged individualism, much of which comes from Ann Bryan, who's a philosopher who wrote books like The Fountainhead. They kind of believe that existing structures hold back progress. I mean, if you talk to Silicon Valley, the cliche is often, you know, we're changing the world, we're making the world a better place. And it isn't until after they've left these companies that they start to see the destruction they've left. So while in the beginning, everyone sort of talks to the people, talks to the authorities, very quickly they get frustrated and they change their approach, which is let's just launch and see what happens. I mean, Facebook called this move fast and break things, but it's the same philosophy that applies in Uber. So they have a playbook whereby they go to a city and then they just start launching the application. And then they hope that they can get enough support from the public that the politicians then won't shut down the service.
Massive corruption involving Uber and its dirty practices have now emerged that show the company's success was not really down to standard business practices. The case, which has come to be known as the Uber files and involves more than 124,000 company files, shed light on the unscrupulous methods used by the company. The files, which are from the period 2013 to 2017, include correspondence, emails, company presentations, and text messages to elected officials.
One of the officials who was secretly consulted by Uber for illegal business advantages was Emmanuel Macron, the then economy minister of France in the government of former President François Hollande. Uber cut a secret deal with Macron to help the company get away with tight regulations of the sector, seen with the current CEO of Uber, Dara Khosrowshahi. So what were those secrets? This is what Ramin Mazohiri, our correspondent in Paris, said.
Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the National Labor Code.
Let's break down what Uber is actually guilty of here. The secret deals that involved Macron and Uber were as follows. The goal, to undermine laws created to regulate Uber safety, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the National Labor Code. Macron also helped Uber consolidate its position in France. The company also approached other top politicians, including then U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and George Osborne, the U.K.'s former Chancellor of Exchequer. Apart from cutting secret deals with politicians, Uber is also accused of jeopardizing the livelihoods of many people. In some cities, Uber initially paid nearly 90% of drivers' hourly earnings in order to drive out competitors. That was essentially giving rides for free, which sent taxi drivers into economic despair. And finally, the controversy which drew the most attention from the drivers was the issue of employment status. Rideshare services Uber and Lyft defended their business model, fighting a law requiring them to reclassify their drivers as employees. The law requires businesses in the gig economy to reclassify independent contractors as employees eligible for unemployment coverage, medical, and other benefits, something both Lyft and another ride-sharing app and Uber have categorically refused to do. Here's one demo that took place in front of the Uber headquarters in San Francisco back in 2020.
All these companies, they're paying under a minimum wage. Protections that people fought for generations prior to this are getting tossed out the window under the language of freelance or flexibility. But if you can't pay someone minimum wage to do their job, you shouldn't have a company.
Why I'm saying no to 22 is because it doesn't do enough. It's really a facade by the companies to try to maintain their profits, to stay in the black instead of the red, and that comes at our expense.
The Uber Files is an example of how cheap money funneled in an extravagant IPO flooded the company with cash, which was unable to venture out into other arenas. Now, whether those other arenas were successful or not, that's a whole other story. However, in the process, politicians were courted and they were lobbied in order to make way for this business. Surprised? You shouldn't be. This is what's called capitalism at its best. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. From Miko Vetakwai and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.